The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Interesting news release from Metals One this morning. Here to tell us about its implications, Jonathan Owen. Jonathan, what's it all about?
Hi, Alistair. Good to be with you. What's it all about? Well, it's doubling our resource base and paving the way for a material change in the pace of the company, really. It moves us squarely out of an exploration into mining, mine development. And that's very exciting for us. This is where we wanted to be. And it's also coming up to our 12-month anniversary since listing. So to achieve all this in such a short time, you know, it's a real testament to the quality of the team and the ambition and the drive to get this done so quickly.
I mean, in simple terms, we're talking in a sense anyway about a doubling of the resource at one level, aren't we? So tell us about the numbers.
So as you might recall, we acquired 28.1 million ton resource at R1, which is just down the road from P5. Today we announced P5 resource numbers for slightly larger 29 million tons. Similar, almost identical grades, similar metal content, etc. The importance of this for us, though, is that it gives us a solid foundation now to move quite quickly into the preliminary economic assessment. So we undertook an internal conceptual economic and technical assessment of the project earlier in the year. I've been quite clear from the start. You know, we continue to target 200 million ton resource over the longer term, over the next couple of years as we go through the feasibility, pre-feasibility, etc. But my question to the consultants did the conceptual work was, do we need to identify a single discrete 200 million ton ore body to make this business work? Or could we look at multiple, let's say, satellite ore bodies, either operating discreetly as independent mines, or maybe feeding or concentrate, or whatever it might be, into a central processing unit? Please look at all these permutations and tell us, where we get best bang for the buck for our shareholders. What's the NPV, IRR, etc. So they did some napkin study, if you like, on that, and came back to us and said, no, this is a highly scalable opportunity you have here. It's low cost mining, low cost processing, high yield in terms of recoveries of the minerals, etc. You can lily pad this. You can leapfrog from one satellite operation to the next, or do them in parallel or stagger them, whichever way you like to maximize your NPV. So what this does then, we have the first, let's say, potential mine at R1. We now have the second at P5. And we've got a sausage machine of other targets coming through over the next year or so to further add other operations onto that. But what it means is we can quite quickly now move into the preliminary economic assessment, a more formal assessment of the business case here. And that's what we're going to do shortly. And the plan is to get that done this year. So to step back a bit and look at our sort of longer term ambition, we're aligning ourselves very much with the Critical Raw Materials Act, the EU's legislation that's driving domestic sourcing of these critical metals, the nickel, the copper, the cobalt, lithium, manganese, there's quite a list of them. They want a percentage of the industry's demand met from local sources, sustainable local sources. And that's what we're looking to actually help contribute to. So they set a benchmark of 2030 to achieve this. So what we've done is basically done a countdown schedule to 2030 of what we need to do when. It's hugely ambitious to get a mine into production in that time scale. We're told by the environmental consultants, we're told by the engineering consultants that it is achievable if we execute perfectly. And I think we can. We have to date. We've delivered on time on drilling, on the mineral resource assessment, etc. So working that back, and I'm going around the houses to get to this point, is we need to do the preliminary economic assessment this year and move into the pre-feas next year, and then very quickly into the full definitive feasibility study the year after. And in the meantime, secure EU grants, EU funding where we can, and secure that the status of strategic project. There is such a thing in the EU that then opens up the project fast-tracking opportunities as well. So the EU will come in and support the fast-tracking of the permitting process for the mine, for the environmental, for social, etc. So ambitious, busy time, But this for us is, you know, the trying to find the metaphor, but this really brings it home that this is something that is real and it's going to happen.
So ambitious plans, lots going on the ground, and also in a context that's quite fast moving and interesting at a kind of macroeconomic level. So tell us first of all about the preliminary economic assessment. Will there be any sort of news flow whilst that's underway, whilst that's happening? Will investors get any kind of updates along the way that they can look forward to? And do you think that there'll be a sort of similar amount of news flow when you move into the pre-fees next year? I mean, it sounds like a sort of fairly aggressive timetable. So certainly you seem like you'll be achieving lots internally. How much are we going to get to hear about?
No, absolutely. So with these ambitious timescales, what I'm looking to do is to front load the critical path items like the baseline environmental studies, etc. Bring those in really this year and get those kicked off this year because they're the items that can often delay projects. So we're going to front load those projects. So you'll see a lot of news flow around appointing environmental contractors, the work that they do then is highly visual. So I'm sure there'll be plenty of pictures of people doing stuff in the field, preliminary assessments on various aspects of the operation, whether it's environmental, engineering, and of course, you know, one of the benefits of having this business model, this multiple operations business model, is that you know, we continue to explore and develop and expand our resources over the next couple of years anyway. So there's still plenty of drilling to do, plenty of results and assays to share, more models and resource estimates to publish. So there's no shortage of news flow.
And how do you see the company positioned in the wider sort of macroeconomic environment? You did allude to it a moment ago when you mentioned the European Union and sort of various strategic accreditations that you could get. But I mean, in terms of the global nickel supply and demand situation, there's Indonesia to consider. You know, there's been a certain amount of interest in the price. You know, where's it going? And that's certainly a bit of an intangible or you know, a difficult conundrum to get to grips with. But what are your thoughts about how the company sits within that sort of broader context?
Yeah, I'm very comfortable. It is, you're absolutely right. Nickel, well, many commodities at the moment are quite volatile, relatively volatile compared to the long-term pricing. But you know, if you're sitting at the lower end of the cost curve as we hope to be, and I'll explain why we expect we will be, then you're kind of protected from that volatility. One of the things that attracted us to this project area when we acquired the assets off BlueJay was the fact that we have an existing operation, or there isn't an existing operation in the area extracting, processing, successfully selling minerals from the same type of ore as us. In fact, it's almost identical, similar grades, and they've been doing that for a few years now. They're constrained from expanding further. So people do ask, well, why don't they just expand further? Well, they have infrastructure constraints, regional zoning constraints, and so on. But what they've demonstrated is two things, two hugely important things. First is economically, they can produce free cash flow throughout the commodity cycle. So when nickel has been through the lowest of its lows, they've still managed to generate 30 to 35% EBIT quarter on quarter. We've seen that recently again, and this is testament to the fact that this type of ore is amenable to bioheat bleaching, so which is a very cost effective way of extracting minerals. It's hugely efficient as well. They're extracting up to 97% of the nickel out of the ore through this method. That compares to a traditional, let's say, massive nickel sulfide deposit in Australia, where you might get recoveries of only 75%. They might be higher grade projects, but they get the economies that we expect to achieve here. And the other major important point, especially in consideration when we're all looking to support the green transition and the digital transitions with the sustainable metals, is they have the lowest carbon footprint of any nickel producer globally. And again, we hope to enjoy the same characteristic. So to put that in perspective, they produce nickel, I think it is about just over 1 ton of CO2 per ton of nickel. Indonesian nickel, you look at it almost, well, over 60 tons of carbon dioxide per ton of nickel. It might be economically cheap in terms of buying Indonesian nickel, but it comes with a huge price, not just in terms of carbon footprint, but also in terms of the environmental and social issues that we see in Indonesia with these Chinese-funded nickel miners, devastating forests and communities and fishing grounds.
Yeah, it certainly has a questionable reputation in Indonesia in some respects. I guess that's a conversation for another day. Tell me about the size of the project you are working on. It sounds like it sounds big, but where does it sort of sit in terms of global economic or global nickel projects? Is it sort of up there with the biggest? Is it a mid-tier project? How do you see it?
I'd say we're junior to mid, rapidly moving up to mid-tier. So the 200 million ton target that we have longer term is where we want to be. That's mid-tier, verging on world-class. Depends how you define what a world-class asset is. Is it on volume? Is it on volume of contained metals? Is it on ability to generate free cash flow throughout the commodity cycle? And it certainly ticks that. It will generate free cash flow, rain or shine. And then it's a question of volume. So that's really the opportunity here, is to continue to build the volumes while having the business case defined and put under the nose at some point of project financiers in the shorter term.
I mean, you were talking about your near neighbor a moment ago as well, and I suppose it's worth sort of slightly broadening out that point to say that you're in an area or a jurisdiction that's familiar with mining. So, if you do get a world-class or a project that is close to world-class, there are going to be people around, both in terms of local communities, government, bureaucrats, who kind of know what to do with a project like that and how to help you make it work, and also how to hold you to account in the ways that any company anywhere in the world ought to be held to account. So it's not like you're sort of entering into an unknown mining area and trying to educate every man and his dog.
No, it's exactly, absolutely right. And that's a risk for a lot of projects, particularly in northern Scandinavia, where you're into Swami reindeer herding territory, Natura 2000 reserves, nature reserves, etc. We don't have any of that. We're quite far south in that respect. We're southeastern Finland, and it is an historic mining region. There are old and existing and new mines being built in the whole region. So that means you're absolutely right. We've got the workforce, potential workforce. We've got the service providers as well, which are hugely important to the success of a project in the area. And then we have the communities themselves, and we have a very good relationship with the communities, with the municipalities around us, and they are hugely welcoming. And these are regions, rural areas that are sort of suffering from an outpouring of GDP, of income, of people as they as they move to the urban centres, because there's not enough employment opportunities there. So they're very welcoming to major industries like mining, to logging, paper mills, etc., to help stem that tide and, in fact, draw people back to these regions. So again, the social license to operate is probably paramount. It's almost up there with the quality of the ore body that you're sitting on. You need that license to operate, and we currently don't see any impediments to maintaining that. And of course, I reference environmental studies kicking off shortly. That includes the social impact assessments as well, which we'll be working closely with the communities to identify and measure what positive impacts we'll be having on the on the local communities.
Well, it all sounds very encouraging. Jonathan Owen, thanks very much for joining us today and talking us through it all.
Thank you, Alistair. Good to be here.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.